All right, good afternoon and welcome to our regular Board of Directors meeting for January 9th, 2018. Roll call, please.
Director Coleman?
Present.
Katz?
Present.
Lenny?
Here.
Mellon?
Present.
Patterson?
Present.
Young?
Present.
President McIntosh?
Present. Please join me for the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands,
one nation, under God,
indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
There are no announcements from closed session. We're moving on to election of officers. Let's open the floor for nominations for President of the Board.
Madam President, I nominate Lisa McIntosh, President of the Board.
A second.
Are there any other nominations from the floor?
I move the nominations be closed.
All right. Nominations are closed. All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstentions? Let's move on to Vice President.
But we have to vote on you first, don't we?
We just did.
I didn't even acknowledge it. Thank you, everybody, for your
congratulations.
My leadership.
For your confidence. I didn't screw up last year, so I get one more shot. So thank you, and it's an honor to represent the district.
I'd like to move Director Patterson as Vice President.
I'll second that.
Any other nominations from the floor? All right. Let's move to close nominations. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstentions? All right. Congratulations.
Thank you, Board members. Thank you.
Bravo. Bravo.
All right. Committee assignments are at your places. Please complete those and get those back before Risha. They should turn them into you, correct?
They turn them into me, and it's by the 16th.
All right. Perfect.
Okay, so I gave you mine.
I'll give that to Risha.
All right.
Okay, thank you. Let's move on to public comment. I have 7 cards for public comment. Let's begin with Piotr Willenswitz and Chris Jerome. Everybody will be speaking together.
Yes. Yes.
All right. Come on up, gentlemen. Followed by Jerome Childs. Piotr and you guys did
separate.
Oh, you did 3 cards.
Yeah, but
thank God. It's only come on up. Will you be speaking together?
Yes.
All right.
Yes. Hi.
Voluntary employee benefits.
Yes, yes.
All right.
Hi. I passed out was a folder in it with there's some information regarding about our company.
Correct.
And there's a questionnaire in there as well. But let me start off. Good afternoon and Happy New Year to you all. Let me introduce myself, my colleagues, and the company that we are proudly a part of. My name is Piotr Vilensevits, but I simply just go by Peter. My colleagues here are Jerome Childs and Christopher Guzman. We're part of New York Life, and just in case you may not be familiar with us, let me quickly point out a few highlights about New York Life. We've been around since 1865. We're number Fortune 500 list. We're number 61. We're the largest mutual company in the U.S., and we've been paying out a dividend for over 160 years. And even though dividends are never guaranteed, we do have a proven track record by having the best ratings in the industry by all the major rating agencies of Moody's, S&P, AM Best, and Finch. And with over 60 years of experience in the workplace market, with over 7,300 active employer groups offering this unique benefit, including some municipalities here locally. So here's a win-win situation for both you and your employees. And with that, I'll let Jerome Childs brief you on this unique employee benefit.
Also, Happy New Year to you all. The benefit that we're proposing for your consideration is called the Employee Whole Life Guaranteed Issue. And with Guaranteed Issue, there's no underwriting, there's no questions, There are no medical exams. The eligibility requirements are as follows. The employee must have worked for 6 months and be full-time, which we consider to be 30 hours. With regards to the amount of insurance that would be covered, for the employee, it would be a maximum of $100,000 face value, minimum of $5,000. For the spouse, it's a maximum of $25,000, and for the minimum is $5,000. And this policy would also cover children and grandchildren with a maximum of $25,000 and a minimum of $5,000. There's basically seven key benefits of our employee whole life policy. Number one is portable. So if the employee should leave the employee of the district, they could take it with them. Secondly, it's permanent. So in addition to providing protection for their family, it also accrues cash value. Third, it's a participating policy, and that means that it will participate in our dividend program, which Peter talked about briefly before. It's convenient because...
That's your time.
You can finish, please.
Okay. The premiums are deducted from their paycheck, and it's affordable. They pick the plan that they want, and the amount is flexible, and it's also family-friendly. And
gentlemen, I while we all appreciate your presentation, it's probably best to make this presentation to staff.
Thank you. I have a copy of the materials, but what I don't have is a copy of your business cards. If you could provide the business cards and a packet, Allison will make sure that it goes to our benefits officer. The district currently provides life insurance for its employees as a part of its benefits, so we can consider your materials in that context. So.
Thank you. Our next speaker is Paul Doro, followed by Stuart Hellman. Paul Doro.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for coming to me.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Good afternoon and Happy New Year to you all. And congratulations to the new slate of officers. I'm a resident of Kensington, a longtime customer of the district, and I'm one of several people who may be addressing you on this subject today, and a larger number of people who could not be here but have communicated, I believe, to all of the directors by email from Stephen Bates, a neighbor of mine in Kensington, who copied me on that email, which was sent yesterday. And I'm here as a result of a fairly new phenomenon, a social media crowdsourced discovery that in our area, and I don't know exactly how big a geography is encompassed in it, there have been in recent months some significantly anomalous water usage readings billed and paid for. In some cases, people have individually contacted your staff and requested assistance to look into it. In other cases, it's just been a matter of people communicating and commenting on Nextdoor, happens to be the social media platform that turned this up. I'll give you my individual case in a minute, but what appears here is that sometime starting in the second half of 2017, water usage readings sort of went through the roof in many cases in a fashion that could not be accounted for by observable leaks, changes in household occupancy, or other logical causes. In my own case, after 8 out of the 12 billing periods through 2017 showed significant decreases consistent with the conservation efforts that were underway, over that period of time. In the last two billing periods, we saw increases of 15%, which is not something to raise your eyebrow, but then a 90% increase in the last billing period of 2017, 38 units, which we have never encountered. My request to you would be to take a look at the material that has been sent to each of you by Mr. Bates, which includes a compilation of spreadsheets like this. About 20 of us have actually researched the bills, at least over the past 2 years, and laid out some information that I think is worth your consideration. I would also ask that you find some way to communicate with us the results of your findings, because while any individual case might be accounted for in any number of reasonable ways, this does seem to be a cluster of anomalous readings. And I hope that there will be some action on this.
Mr. General Manager?
Yes, thank you. We received Mr. Bates's email this morning by way of Director Coleman. And so staff and I had a chance to scroll through it. So staff will go through each one of the, I believe there are about 90 different accounts,
right.
Work to understand each unique situation, and then we'll be getting back, and I'll consider how we might be able to communicate with the group as a whole. So we'll take it very seriously and look into it and provide a report to the board so they can appreciate what's been done. But
thank you. That's much appreciated.
And we do have your contact information.
Thank you.
Thank you. Stuart Hellman, followed by Josh Baxter.
I'm Stuart Hellman. I want to mirror just what he said, because looking at our bill, for no changes in our household, we went from an average of 4,000 gallons a billing period to 10,000. We had 113% increase at that second billing period during 2017, where it went from 3,000 gallons to 12,716. We didn't do anything different. There's two people, two adults in a household, and no guests, as I remember, during that period, and hardly watering, because I'm a gardener that does native Californians. So I appreciate what your comments were about looking into our bills and see what can be done. Thank you.
Thank you. Josh Baxter, followed by Marty Mertens, and that's the last speaker.
Good afternoon.
Good morning.
Hi.
Good afternoon.
My name is Josh Baxter, and I am in this cohort. I'm the one who started the Nextdoor online social media to see what was going on with the high billing. We had had the initial reading of 30 units being used on the October-November 2017 statement, which was 20 units more than the previous year. Something that was, we didn't have a leak, there was no, nothing going on there to prove that 30 units. So I started the whole online questionnaire, see if anybody else had this. We did have a technician come out on December 27th, and what was interesting is that she noted on our bill that it said it was an estimated reading of the 30 units, and what I'm finding is that a lot of us have these new meters. So I think it's stemming from the way that they're being electronically read, so that my understanding is that now the technicians don't, or the meter readers don't have to lift up the cement cover and actually read the meter, that it's being electronically read. So as it turns out, we had only used 7 units in that billing period, and not the 30 units. So we did get a credit for that. So for that, we're appreciative. But in speaking on behalf of everybody, I would just like to reiterate what Paul and Marty talked about. I have a hard copy of those spreadsheets if you need that. And we, in gathering that data, we noticed that there's about a 30%, anywhere from a 30% to a 1,300% increase in the water usage from the same billing period of last year. So thank you for looking into this. I think you know, we obviously are grateful for all your stewardship of our water supplies, but we would appreciate this being looked into. We're happy, obviously, to pay for the water that we're using. Just over and above that is exorbitant. So thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Our last speaker, Marty Mertin.
Well, members of the board, well, I appreciate the water we get so much. I just wanted to add my support to the previous speakers and say I live in Park Hills, the neighborhood in Berkeley. I just wanted to say that many of us in our neighborhood are very puzzled by the fact that our bills are so different. I just want to give an example. September through November bill for 1916 was 14 units. And then for September and November 2017, it was 41 units. And we have a native plant garden, and there's just two of us, and we don't have a leak. So it looks like it is quite a widespread problem, because between 60 and 90 that signed in onto the social media, but there may be many more. So we trust you, and we just think we're not aware of the problem. So we hope it can be remedied. And thank you for your time.
Thank you for coming. That was our last speaker for public comment.
I have a question for Alex. Excuse me, Alex. I know these are the AMI meters that we're probably talking about. Have we found there to be a problem of discrepancy with other agencies using these meters? Some people talked about they used, 14 units, and they were actually used 7, and they're charged 41 or something like that. Has that been an issue with other agencies that use a similar meter or the same brand of meter? If we could find that out. And the other issue, I think Mr. Bates has emailed to all of us, mentioned how long it took to get the refund check back, which seemed exceedingly long. And I don't know what our process is on that, if it's just a credit on the next bill or if we actually issue a check.
We will include that information when we provide a response, trying to explain everything that we learn in reviewing Mr. Bates's information. So we'll, one of the reasons that we are conducting pilots is because if we went district-wide, this could be potentially broadly impactful. So we'll try to understand what's happening with adjacent communities that are using AMI and share that with you.
Thank you.
All right, that moves us on to the consent calendar. Director Mellon would like to remove item number 8. Do we have a motion?
I'll move 1 through 7 and 9.
We have a second.
Second.
Any other items to be pulled or questions asked? Hearing none, all in favor? Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstentions? Director Mellon.
My only reason for pulling 8 is that I want to vote no.
All right. Do we have a motion on item number 8?
I'll move 8.
Do we have a second?
I'll second.
If there's no further discussion, all in favor? Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed?
No.
Any abstentions? All right. The motion passes with 1 no. Let's move on to determination and discussion. It's my understanding that item 10 is being removed, Mr. General Manager.
That is correct. And so then proceeding on to item 11, we have Marlene Dumain, who will introduce our guest.
Yes.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. We have a special guest, Eric Saperstein, here.
So
The Eric Saperstein. He flew in just for us.
Will we be getting autographed copies of this presentation?
Opportunity to get our picture taken with
him. Are you mentioned in the book? That's what I want to know.
Can't get pictures taken, remember?
That's right.
he's going to give a presentation of what's happening in Washington. It'll be very clear. And then I'll follow with the federal initiatives.
You can be clear about Washington?
So I was going to say Happy New Year. I was going to say Happy New Year to everybody, but now a little fire and fury instead.
Welcome, Eric.
Love Eric.
Thank you. Happy New Year, all.
A lot of explaining to do.
All right, let me see if I can figure this machine out. Hey. All right, so today, as Marlene said, I'm going to give you a brief update on what's going on in Washington, looking forward for the next year's time, and then that'll lead into the federal initiatives that Marlene and I have been working on to present to you. So the first thing is, what are the impacts for the 2018 session that effectively starts this coming, or yesterday, with the House returning to work and the Senate came in earlier the previous week. The next thing I want to go over is administration appointments, not because there's anything earth-shattering by themselves, but I want to sort of give you a sense of who's running the ship, state, so to speak, outside of the White House. And then what the priorities are for the congressional and administration. And when I say priorities for congressional, I'm really talking about the Republican leadership, because they do set the agenda, and the Democrats, as a loyal opposition, say yay or nay during the debate. And then finally, just quickly go over the core priorities for 2018 for the district that Marlene will speak more deeply about. So when people ask me, generally, what's it like in Washington? There was a joke floating around last week that I think captures it all. It's got nothing to do with the president's being a genius or what have you, and that we're all sort of listening for his pronouncements. But it's a little bit like a person is standing on top of a 50-story building. They fall off. and about the 25th floor, someone pokes their head out and says, how's it going? And the person says, oh, so far, so great. And I think, you know, that's how it is in Washington right now. So far, so great. We'll see what happens when we hit on the bottom of the 50-story building.
It's 9 days into the year,
and only a handful of months before the real games start with the election. On the election, I do want to say one, shall we say, breaking news piece. Before we started today, I got a sort of a thing from Politico that said that Senator Harris has decided to leave her post on the Environment and Public Works Committee to join the Judiciary Committee, which is really interesting because aside from the fact that we've always had a California member on the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee as long as I can remember history of the committee's activities, it tells you how high the stakes are in Washington right now, and having two California senators sitting on the Judiciary Committee. Senator Feinstein is a ranking Democrat, and now Senator Harris will join, and I think that's driven by the debates over immigration, the debates over a potential impeachment debate next year if the House and the Senate turn, and those sorts of things. So just a sort of update on sort of committee assignment changes.
Eric, if Senator Harris is leaving that committee, where does that leave us turning for WERDA, Clean Water Act, all the issues that are so important to our agency?
Good question. So I will get into that, but very quick response to that question. We're not at a disadvantage because the issues that we care about, she will still be able to weigh in on the House or on the Senate floor, first of all. Second of all, she will have a rapport and give and take with the members on the committee that she used to be on. WERDA, particularly, Water Resource Development Act, is a bipartisan effort. They put out requests to the senators for projects to be considered as part of a WERDA that will start happening in the next couple of weeks in the Senate. So on that level, she'll still be a player. Also, you have Senator Feinstein, who sits still in control of the budget for all things water on the Appropriations Committee, and she will carry significant clout in making certain that California and the district's priorities are taken into account. I don't want to suggest that it's a change without some kind of consequence, but we will survive.
How does it get decided who's going to changing a committee like that? How does that?
So part of it is a function, if you recall, that you know Senator Al Franken left the Senate. Senator-elect, now Senator Jones from Alabama, came in so as a Democrat. So there are a whole bunch of sort of moving chairs that occur. And that's so the, in this case, Chuck Schumer, the minority leader for the Democrats, makes a decision based on what the members ask for. And that's how it happens. Okay. So factors impacting, if you will, the 28th session. So it's clear that when you think about it, there are probably three factors in a sort of summary way that impact the 2018 session. The first is going to be, when you think about it, the fact that the House and the Senate majorities are at risk. Right now, the Senate majority is at 51-49, the House majority, 24-seat Republican advantage. And we're looking at record retirements in the House. Most recently in California, Representative Ed Royce, a senior member of the Republican leadership in the House as the Foreign Affairs Committee chairman, announced yesterday he's retiring. So there is a seat that district-wise went for Hillary Clinton in 2016. So at the end of the day, you see another seat at risk to go into the Democratic column, setting up the potential for the House majority to be significantly reduced, if not eliminated, in the November election. So that will color things with respect to how policy is debated in this coming year. The second thing is the Senate. You've got a 51-49 majority in the Senate. Here's the issue. Most likely now, it's highly unlikely that the Senate will turn to that magic 60 number with respect to avoiding filibusters after the election. Part of that is a function that you've got three senators right now. Two are leaving, Senator Flake and Senator Corker on the Republican side. And then you have Susan Collins, who is, for all intents and purposes, a centrist member of the Senate who will vote based on the issues rather than party alliance or allegiance. So you've got essentially a Senate that is evenly divided at any given time. And even at 51-49, it's hard to get anything done. So I don't see how the Senate going forward can do anything except on a bipartisan basis at this stage of the game. The second thing to consider is, as I said, the 60-vote margin. I mentioned that that is a filibuster-proof margin. Because that looks highly unlikely in the 2018 elections to come about in the Senate, that will be another forcing mechanism for bipartisanship if they want to get anything done in the next 10 months' time. And then the third thing is the Me Too, hashtag Me Too issue. Don't underestimate the intensity and the life of this issue, at least in Congress right now. There are rumors, and they're only rumors, but there are rumors that we're looking at maybe as much as 40 members that could still be caught up in this whole debate on sexual harassment, workplace harassment in general. And that could color what goes on in the legislative process, both in the Senate and in the House. So those are sort of the sort of top-tier issues as far as, call it gossip or whatever else that could happen with respect to influencing activities. Substantively, here's the issue that I think is really going to matter, budget debate. So right now, as we speak, the 2018 budget has yet to be finalized for the remaining 8 to 9 months of this year. It expires, the stopgap expires on January 19th. At this stage of the game, it's anybody's guess whether they will cut a deal or they'll have to punt again in Congress and extend the continuing resolution for another couple of weeks. If they don't get a deal, and it looks incredibly elusive to get a deal, they'll probably go to a year-long continuing resolution, simply because they've got to start focusing on the fiscal year 2019 budget, which, if you want fire and fury, will be a huge issue. The White House is expected to impose a budget that not only will be dead on arrival, it will have rigor mortis before it gets to the Senate and the House for consideration. It will cut significantly domestic agency spending beyond what we saw in 18. There are rumors that water resource project spending will be almost zeroed out, water recycling, what have you. Now, of course, the Office of Management Budget that writes the budget for the federal system to go to the Congress knows that Congress will put this back in. But that's one of the issues that will be front and center as far as how do we prioritize domestic spending. The
Eric,
other thing that...
Eric, how does that fit into the president's infrastructure goals? I thought, wouldn't that be part of the infrastructure?
It conflicts greatly with the infrastructure issue. I will tell you that it casts a real sort of pall on the whole thing because the administration, at least the president, said he wanted to preserve the existing core water resource projects, funding programs and funding of those projects. Now what we're looking at is a potential where he's seeking to cut those programs and project fundings and then move to an infrastructure policy that I will get to in a second. But at the end of the day, it does create a real challenge of putting the things together and how do you make it work. And the big issue for 2019 is going to be whether or not we have a sequestration fight, because the effort on the Republican side is to really boost defense spending. Obviously, on the Democratic side, it's if you want to have defense spending increases, you have to have domestic program spending increases. And that's going to be a big fight. And depending on how that comes out, we will see, you know, what translates into program spending. I don't want to say it's up in the air. These, you know, the men and women of the Congress end up ultimately doing something and getting something in place. My guess is, given the high stakes of the election coming up and control of Congress, a deal will be cut eventually to get both 18 done, get a disaster assistance bill done, get the DACA immigration issue solved or at least resolved for a couple of years so they can go forward and then campaign. But these are the issues sort of that are going to influence the session that we're in right now. So just so you get a sense of how fast this is going to happen, in any election cycle, the session is really truncated. Congress, as I said, returned a couple days ago. They have to finalize the 2018 budget. I have up there January 19th because that's the official date, but that's probably going to fall by the wayside. We'll have another continuing resolution for at least a couple of weeks. And then the State of the Union happens on January 30th, and that's where the fireworks begin. Because I fully expect the president will talk about immigration, building the wall, and sort of throwing down a gauntlet, if you will, to the Democrats to see what they will or will not do. Then the budget goes up to Congress shortly after the State of the Union on February 5th, and that's where you'll see for the first time the severity, is my guess, of the budget cuts of programs that are cherished by the Democratic minority and to a large degree the Republican majority on the domestic level. And that will set up the debate as what will or will not happen in the coming months. Appropriations and budget resolutions up there. And then, of course, the final budget is enacted on September 30th. Don't hold your breath. They'll probably leave town with an extended continuing resolution until December. So from a key milestone perspective, the next 3 to 4 months are going to be really important to determine what happens on policy issues in general, because after that, it really does get to be a sort of holding pattern when it comes to the budget process and funding, and also legislating it for the next couple of months. So, from the administration settling in, I want to sort of draw your attention to a couple of important things. Yes, the White House is in disarray at any given moment, and you see that in the papers, and that partly stems from a desire of this White House to operate wholly different. We all know about Twitter. I won't go into any further than that. But here's what I want you to focus on. The appointments that are already in place for the most part, whether you politically or philosophically agree with them, they are smart people. And why I emphasize that is because a lot of things are happening under the radar screen that impact the district, impact the environmental laws of, and regulations of the nation. You have David Bernhardt, who is in office at Interior as a number two person to the Secretary Ryan Zinke. Many of you may know of Bernhardt because he represented Cadiz and Westlands. He is the man who runs the Department of the Interior now. Brenda Berman, commissioner now of the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation, with its jurisdiction over any number of things from your contract under the Central Valley Project to water recycling. Brenda used to work at the Bureau of Reclamation, worked on the Hill, and then worked for the Metropolitan Water District in Sacramento. She is now in place at the Bureau. She understands where the bodies are buried and what can or cannot be done and how to play the game. Tim Petty, an assistant secretary for Water Science, no relation to Tom Petty. Tim is a knowledgeable former Hill staffer. He will run the show on a day-to-day basis for all things on water and science in the Department of Interior. He does have responsibility over Brenda from a management standpoint. But again, another sort of, shall we say, seasoned official in the department running things on a day-to-day basis, which will have an impact on how they deal with Congress and say yay or nay on any kind of policy issues. EPA, you all know about Scott Pruitt, but taking a closer look at EPA and who is in charge of EPA and what that means for water quality programs and infrastructure and what have you. Andrew Wheeler, deputy administrator, the number two guy, used to be the chief of staff to Senator James Inhofe on the Environment and Public Works Committee, and most recently worked for one of the largest coal companies in the country as their lead lobbyist. David Ross, assistant administrator for water, a key position for the district on drinking water as well as clean water issues. David Ross is an attorney trained at the Vermont Law School, which gives you some pause and maybe hope that this is a person who understands the laws of the land. He has gotten from a line staff perspective and talking with him at EPA. They like him, he listens to them, and whether he comes up with a decision they like, they are not even concerned about that at this point. They just want to have somebody they can talk to. So that's an encouraging point. Susan Bodine, former assistant administrator under George W. Bush for Superfund, then worked as a senior staff counsel and then general counsel for the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee, again for Jim Inhofe. I think you get a sense of where this is headed. And then finally, keep in mind with Susan, she is in charge of enforcement. She will make the call, not so much on litigating, because that goes to the Justice Department, but she'll make the call on whether to initiate actions against violators of the Clean Water Act, the Safe Drinking Water Act, Superfund, what have you. So before I get to the White House, the message I want to leave with you is these are folks, again, who understand the laws. Whether you agree with them or not, intellectually, they have an understanding from their years of working on the issues, what they can or cannot do, and they will be very clever in their approaches.
Business Week has categorized the cast of characters and their appointments as being the foxes all being put in charge of the chicken coop.
Yeah, I think that's, as the saying goes, is this being recorded? Yes,
it is. And so I'm just simply making a statement that you don't have to
I will tell you that we have not seen appointments that are this ideologically rigid to the right of the spectrum in ages. I guess the last time would be Ronald Reagan. Even George W. Bush did not have folks that were this to the right on the political spectrum in charge. But again, these are people who know the laws, okay? These are people who know how to make them turn to their advantage. So I just sort of say that out loud. Then turning to the White House, a couple important things. DJ Gribben, he's special assistant to the president for infrastructure. Let me jump over Kathleen for a second. Alex Hergott is director for infrastructure of the Council of Environmental Quality. These two folks are running the infrastructure policymaking apparatus for the president. DJ Gribben comes from the Department of Transportation, where he ran the TIFIA program, which is equivalent to the WIFIA program, highly subsidized loans for big projects. And Alex comes, again, from the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee, where he worked with Senator James Inhofe. Again, another example of how concentrated the focus is on both the ideology as well as the experience. And Kathleen Hartnett, executive director nominee for CEQ. The reason she's up there is that not so much that she is yet to be CEQ director, the head of the whole shooting works, and under this administration, CEQ truly is operating as an overlord, if you will, on managing how agencies go ahead with rulemakings and what have you, alongside the Office of Management and Budget. More important is, unfortunately, Kathleen Hartnett, who has to get Senate confirmation, got a series of questions as follow-up from her testimony before the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee. And she sent those questions up, or the answers up to those questions after the hearing, which is normal. One minor problem. She plagiarized 17 answers. So that didn't help expedite the confirmation process. The committee on a bipartisan basis said, I think you got to get your act together and give us your real answers. That was the message that went back. The committee further said, we've run out of time. The session's coming to an end last year. You're going to have to renominate Kathleen Hartnett. Oh, by the way, this is somebody who doesn't believe in climate change also on the record during her confirmation hearing.
Is she the one that there was a viral video about one of, I think it was her, about
yes.
It just completely bombing on mm-hmm. questions from, I think it was Al Franken, about climate change and the environment and
yes.
just doing a
yeah.
horrible
so, yeah,
job,
so,
even by, you know, anybody's standard, I think.
That's right. And so, you know, she did at one point retract a little bit of that and said, well, yeah, maybe it's out there. I'll take another look at it. But anyway, her nomination is back, is being considered for renomination and set up to the committee. But as they say, you know, that in the sports, that's your team, and this is who's running the show right now. You know, it will be a tough year. I don't expect anything other than an aggressive continuation of what we've seen on the rulemaking front. But I think you're going to see a lot of pushback, too, in Congress at this point because, again, the implications of what the election brings. So, congressional and administration policy priorities. I mentioned the 19 budget. I think this is a really big one. Everybody's talking about infrastructure, but here's the deal. I fully expect that on February 5th, we will have a budget that will cut the daylights out of the domestic side of the budget. But more important, it will also seek to reorganize the federal government, collapse programs into smaller entities, if you will, move programs from one agency to another agency, sometimes with merit, sometimes with a political agenda. And then, of course, try and figure out, you know, how to eliminate programs entirely based on either waste, fraud, and abuse rubric, or just a decision that this is not part of our priority. That's what we have to look out for and watch, because you could see programs wholesale being eliminated through the budget process. And while this is a little bit inside the Beltway, it's important because if they don't do it through the budget process, you've got tens of congressional committees and subcommittees in both the House and the Senate that would have an opportunity to review a governmental reorganization process on a sort of piecemeal basis. So using the budget will allow for an expedited approach to reorganizing the federal government, probably something not seen as far as a recommendation goes since, to be kind, maybe Jimmy Carter when he tried to reorganize the federal government, but clearly back to FDR days when they reorganized the federal government. That's something to watch out for. Infrastructure policy. This is the big one, okay? Everybody talks about it. The president actually was talking about it this past weekend when he threw cold water on the core element of his infrastructure policy with his economic advisors by his side when he said, I don't think public-private partnerships are that great a deal. I don't see how they're going to work. Notwithstanding his ability to sort of diminish his own proposals in public, infrastructure policy, here's the takeaway for now. One, we will have to really advocate hard to maintain core programs like the State Revolving Loan Fund program. The president campaigned that he wanted to triple the investment to $3 billion for the Clean Water State Revolving Loan Fund program on an annual basis. Now what his infrastructure policy is probably going to say is what we need to do is rely heavily on WIFIA-type programs, highly subsidized loan assistance through the Department of the Treasury. We need to look at leveraging public-private partnerships. We're going to get that $1 trillion for investment through the private sector. We'll give about $200 billion over 10 years out of the federal coffers. But that money probably won't go to projects like at East Bay Mud. They'll go for transformative projects. This is what D.J. Gribben has said. Transformative projects are things like a Cadiz project in the Mojave Desert, projects that are desalinization that may or may not be feasible because of the price of the water that comes out. I guarantee you it won't be the high-speed rail system, but it will be...
Well, you
guys have created a real mess for yourselves. But having said that, the other thing that could happen is it could be a mechanism to do the Delta tunnels. Remember, going back and why it's important, remember that the guy who is running the Department of Interior, number two, has steeped in professional work experiences on the Delta issues. And so they could theoretically consider the Delta solution, the twin tunnels or single tunnels or whatever they end up being, a transformative project, which means huge amounts of federal money to support that project as opposed to individual water supply projects that might be scattered throughout the state of California. And I make those references and examples because these were actual projects that were identified in a disowned transition paper by the Trump administration way back a year or so ago, where they said these are the 50 top projects that we should be building. And Cadiz, the Delta tunnels, things like that were part of those 50 projects. And then the other thing to keep in mind with the infrastructure policy debate and why it's important to weigh in on it is one of the other elements of the initiative that we expect the president to unveil in about 10 days' time is a decision that in order to get federal assistance for infrastructure under the infrastructure policy that the White House will announce, it will, aside from the transformative projects, you will be eligible to get federal assistance as a project sponsor provided you win. And how do you win? By demonstrating that the amount of federal money that you would like is limited. So if you have, if Director Patterson has a project seeking $80 million and Director Linney has a project seeking $25 million, and on review, they each have merit, they will give the assistance under the way it's being proposed to Director Linney because he's only asking for $25 million. And that is their logic in how to stretch limited federal resources, as opposed to you have projects, they have a value, there is a need, the community needs that assistance, you should fund them, whether through the State Revolving Loan Fund program or a WIFIA program or what have you. So these are the type of dynamics that are at play. And then finally, aside from the qualification of eligibilities, then the question becomes, what are the uses for those dollars? You know, and they whether it's for, expansion or alternative water supply projects or whatever, those are the things that we have to wait and see what the administration is proposing as a eligible category for funding. Having sort of put that out there for your knowledge, I will tell you that the good news is that within Congress, there is continued strong support for maintaining the core programs that fund the nation's water infrastructure. And if infrastructure from a national perspective just crashes and burns, at the same time, we fully expect that the water committees and subcommittees in the House and Senate will continue to move forward on their own water infrastructure initiatives.
Eric, going back to Senator Harris leaving the committee, and you pretty much assured us we'll be okay, who can be an ally in the Senate on the Water Infrastructure Committee that California might be able to go to that will help listen versus just Harris or Feinstein putting in a request?
So a quick response to that would be somebody like Senator Ben Cardin from Maryland. Ben Cardin has consistently been one of the leaders in addressing water quality issues, water infrastructure needs, because he's got the Chesapeake Bay in his state. And many of the Chesapeake Bay issues are line up nicely with the issues that, you know, challenge California waterways. So he would be a classic example of somebody to work with to push issues before, and his staff are very receptive to California because some of the staff actually hail from California. So that's a quick answer.
And will Senator Harris have a point person in her office to deal with these issues?
Yes. There is a fellow by the name of Kevin Chang in Senator Harris's office who came on with the senator, worked the campaign, but more importantly, worked for Senator Feinstein before he joined Senator Harris. And he is very... as they all seem to be these days, very young, but he is incredibly clever and sharp. And so I have no hesitation to say that irrespective of the senator leaving the committee, her staff are totally plugged into the effort.
Great. Thank you.
And then quickly, streamlining the permitting process will be another element of the infrastructure policy the White House puts out. And we'll see what that translates into, but my guess is a little bit like, okay, you have a project, you got your environmental documentation, good, okay, you're good to go within 60 to days to 3 months time frame. So we'll see how that breaks out, but I think that's going to be a very, very big, very large looming flashpoint when they have the debate on infrastructure, how to streamline the regulatory process. When we look at Endangered Species Act reform, this is the policymaking effort that just keeps on coming. And, you know, they roll out the issues to essentially eliminate it. That's why this cartoon says what it says about C-SPAN moving to Congress, taking up the appropriations bill, and the Lesser Prairie Chicken Must Die Act. They will try everything in their power in Congress to figure out ways to eliminate ESA. And I choose those words carefully and with consciousness because that's what's all at stake right now is an effort to essentially emasculate the Endangered Species Act through either streamlining the process or limiting, you know, the ability to have multiple agencies weigh in on the review process when a permit is sought for a project. So we'll have to watch that because that could have consequences to the district's activities when it comes to fisheries and restoring the ecosystem. And I threw immigration in there because God knows how that's going to muck up the works, but it's out there. And, you know, the one thing I like to say about the wall is it's sort of true. He doesn't really need a wall. He just needs a win and showing that they're getting something. My guess is, at the end of the day, that something would translate into another tax bill fight, and I don't think the Democrats would allow, as you've seen this past week over the debate of his request for funding of the wall, that will allow anything to happen on immigration like a wall. And that, you know, will still be a priority. They will push that right up to Election Day, and so that may or may not impact ultimately what gets done outside of those types of issues. you know, I think at the end of the day, you have to ask yourself, well, what are the core priorities before Marlene comes up here? Let me just zip right through sort of the essence of it. You can break it into environment, water environment, and infrastructure policy. And from the Central Valley Project, it's all about cost allocations and who pays for what in the evolving debate over management of the Central Valley Project and water delivery supplies. Don't be surprised if efforts are made sort of as a Hail Mary pass to, in this last session of Congress, that some interests that depend on the Central Valley Project try to shift the costs. I won't get it. It's too, shall we say, complex to get into details today, but that's one thing to look out for. On water resources issues in general, whether it's the Endangered Species Act, clean water, or anything in between, it's all about no adverse impacts to the district's needs. And then forestry. Given this fire season, given what has happened, given the sort of banging of the drum on how to deal with both the overborrowing of Forest Service day-to-day operating funds to fight fires, as well as the sort of drumbeat on how do we address the health of forests so that we don't have these catastrophic fires taking place year after year after year. I think that the key here will be to make certain that any policies that are developed, and they will be developed, that's one thing I'm convinced of, because the disaster dollars are so huge to the federal treasury that that's the motivating factor, is to make certain that resiliency is promoted under funding so that you're not stealing money from operating programs, and that you're treating forestry or wildfire suppression needs like any other natural disaster. And the other issue is management. How do you manage those forests that need some kind of environmentally sensitive approach to hopefully be helpful in preventing huge wildfire events from erupting over the next several fire seasons? So those are sort of the water environment in a snapshot. And then on infrastructure policy, you know, you look at what's going to happen and you think about the debate and the issues that I talked about. At the end of the day, it's all about the forms of assistance. Is it grants? Is it loans? Is it a hybrid of those? Is it public-private partnerships? That's the first thing. And the second thing is going to be, how can you use that assistance in what areas? Is it water recycling? Is it desal? Is it water treatment? Where do the dollars fall and how are they, you know, allocated within those activities? And then eligibility. You know, who gets the dollars? As I referenced earlier, the infrastructure approach the administration is looking at is going to rely heavily on public-private partnerships. How do you protect the core programs and the commitment that the federal government has to maintain to promote, if you will, meaningful partnerships with state and local governments, especially in light of the tax bill and what that has done to states like California? The importance of maintaining a strong financial commitment for local communities to build their infrastructure. So with that, as I said, there's a lot there. It is a little bit, as I said at the beginning, like falling off a building. It's 50 stories high, and we're in the middle of the free fall. But at the end of the day, you know, you have to be an optimist, and you have to assume that whatever happens in this session, that Congress will sort of step up and protect the core programs and put the brakes on, shall we say, extreme solutions to problems that don't demand those kind of solutions. I'm going to stop there, Marlene. And did you want to, or did I, are there any questions? Or?
So I don't particularly like the analogy, because even though it might be okay halfway, you know it's not going to end well a little bit later. What do you sense, what's the... I guess I'm asking you to summarize somewhat here. How do we approach this differently than we would have, you know, 2 years ago or 3 years ago in looking for some funding? What does it mean for East Bay MUD in our approach?
So there's two ways to answer that. The first way is an aggressive approach to finding dollars that are out there, even if they're small dollars, to get you moving forward on project delivery. From a project standpoint, leave regulatory and policy like that to the side for a second. Because, you know, we're going through this annual ritual, once again, according to reports today, that the Republicans are looking at bringing back earmarks. Why? Because they're scared to death. They're about to lose the Congress control of it. So let's just fantasize for a second that they bring back, for true public purpose, earmarks. Then having projects that are in the queue, having projects that people know about, makes it possible, perhaps, if earmarks were to come back, to get funding for those projects. Speculation, but that's one suggestion. The other issue is to think innovatively about what financing tools are out there. Consider the fact that while interest rates continue to be, you know, modestly low, that you know, the district may want to look at things like the Water Infrastructure Finance and Innovation Act, otherwise known as WIFIA, if it has a very, very large project that could be funded through alternative mechanisms. And then finally, from a disaster assistance point of view, one of the things that is coming out of the hurricanes and out of the fires is a decision to start refunding or reinvesting in FEMA, Federal Emergency Management Agency, pre-disaster mitigation grants type work. And that might help on disaster, on earthquake preparedness or anything else related to disaster preparedness. So I think that's the first thing. The second thing is, from a regulatory policymaking standpoint, not that the district has been shy in the past, but I would argue where there's something that is of defined, special, intense, whatever interest to the district's mission, goals, and objectives, to be forceful in responding to things that may or may not be coming out of the federal bureaucracy. Because I think you will see the agencies, whether it's Interior, EPA, or any of the other alphabet organizations, putting things out to see if they can get changes while Congress is busy fighting over budgets and what have you. So that was the other thought I had.
Thank you very much.
I just had one question about, given 17 being such a disastrous year with all the fires and hurricanes and everything else, displacement, they haven't put up any real money to address that, just temporary funding. Is anything substantial going to be coming through, particularly for our fires and other devastation we've had here in California?
Yeah. So the quick answer is yes. There's an $81 billion disaster, supplemental disaster assistance bill pending in the Senate right now, passed the House. The challenge is right now going particularly to wildfires. There's unhappiness over the level of commitment of dollars for wildfire assistance. And there's also similarly some unhappiness with the level or the way the money would be allocated on the hurricane-related activities. My guess is when it's all over, the Senate will force some changes on the House-passed bill. They will approve it and get the dollars out. And there will be unclear how much money will ultimately go to wildfire recovery efforts, but there will be billions in it for recovery efforts. And there will also be, going back to what I was just saying earlier, there will be language in there to deal with resiliency and allow folks to put in place responses that are focused on tomorrow's challenges as opposed to just rebuilding to the standards of today that precipitated perhaps some of the consequences due to resiliency issues.
I noticed recently pushback on the part of insurance companies. And is anybody looking at that as any supplemental things that can happen for the losses of people in that area going forward, since insurance is kind of, they really just aren't going to rewrite people insurance.
Right. So there are provisions more to flood insurance, that there are provisions that begin to figure out a way to at least replenish the flood insurance program and response. But to the point that you're raising, as far as dealing with the insurance companies, there's not a whole lot in there.
Okay. That answers my last question.
Thank you, Eric.
Thank you very much.
Marlene.
As Marlene's coming up in our ledge committee this morning, we did adopt by a 3-0 vote all four of the federal initiatives.
Does anyone have any specific questions on the federal initiatives? I'm going to run through them real quickly. Okay. Thank you. Okay, I'm going to run through these very quickly. Out of order, just to mix it up a little bit, but I will start with number one. This first one is the one that speaks to the idea of efforts to get rid of the ESA, the Endangered Species Act. It also speaks to efforts to rewrite the CVPIA in a way that gets rid of the environmental water account. And this is not new. This is something we've been watching for quite a while and working on through the various drought bills. We think that the efforts are going to continue. That's what initiative number one is about. Initiative number three.
Actually, Marlene, I have a question related to that.
Yeah.
Was based on what Eric was talking about and on this, since this is so much of, a lot of these are, some of these in issue one are UMRA issues in terms of water rights and flows and things of that nature. Is there any chance, probably not, of the congressman representing that area to be Mr. McClintock, I believe it is, to have the UMRA agencies, Amador and Calaveras County Water District and others, to engage him to help it, have some understanding of what the implication is to them as well as to us? Loaded question. Yes,
it is a loaded question because when you look at the agency that's invested in the health of that fishery and the agency that is doing so much and has done so much, and the ones that are 90% of our water is coming from that river, it's really, we are the primary at risk on this.
But if we're impacted, then they're going to be impacted at some point. Because if there's more flows need to be released down for the CVP, not only are we going to have to release, give up some of our water, they are too.
May I just add that I think this links to a prior conversation that we had where we were speaking about the voluntary agreement that we're working to try to engage with the state in as it relates to the Water Quality Control Plan Phase 2, and that we had talked about having an update for UMRA. And so that brings all of this together. It's flows and fish. And so I think in that venue we could think, well, at least we can bring everybody up to speed, yeah, and then think about if there's a next step.
Well, it's not only UMRA and us. Quite frankly, it's the Mountain County Association, the headwaters in the Sierra Nevadas that have, you know, McClintock represents much of that area. Many of these agencies potentially could be negatively impacted on the CVP discussion that's being talked about. And I don't know, you know, you probably deal with this mountain, you know, the Mountain County people water, and
yeah,
and you know, then through Eric's DC work, these people have to understand that they too may be impacted on their water rights and flows. And we did see McClintock, at least on one time on the tax thing, at least vote one way, and then he changed it, I think, the second time. But he did back off on another flow issue several years ago when it was raised by some of the Mountain County agencies. I mean, and he's going to be critical in the committee he's on doing this. And maybe he can become an ally, not likely, but maybe he won't push it.
I think it's something that we can look at, and I think carefully, and through UMRA and through the others, in a way that doesn't displace our independent effort of
okay.
East Bay Mud. Yeah.
Okay.
Issue three.
Go for it.
Okay. Issue three is this. This is about the cost allocation issue for the Central Valley project. This really speaks to WaterFix and the proposal that has been floated to find a way to show that the Central Valley project does benefit from WaterFix and reallocate those costs so that non-benefiting agencies like East Bay MUD would be asked to pay. That's what initiative number three is about. Initiative number two is about infrastructure, and I know Eric said that Congress is talking about earmarks again, and certainly if that opportunity arose, we would be right there. We have authorized, we have projects with existing authorizations now that we would love to get funded. But I think the reality check is that really going to happen? I think we have to assume not, but be ready if it does, and really look at infrastructure in terms of what policy ideas they're looking at and help them frame what would make sense for funding that's consistent with how we look at the future. And then the last one is the healthy forest issue, and that is something that we've been working through UMRA, but the long-term policy solution has not occurred at the federal level, and so as proposals come through again, as we get appropriate ones to bring to the board, we watch out for those and bring them forward for position consideration as well here.
I will move acceptance of the four federal initiatives.
All right, we have a motion and a second. Any questions, comments? All in favor?
Aye.
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 Any opposed? Any abstentions? All right.
And I will come back at the next my next board meeting with a state report. I think we may see some changes between now and then, and the governor's budget is out tomorrow, so I'll have a little more info for you then.
Thank you, Marlene.
Thank you.
And Eric. All right, ladies and gentlemen, on to GM's report.
All right, so it's the beginning of the year, and this is traditionally when we start providing water supply updates.
I'm sorry, just one second. There was other action at the legislative committee related to the public. Well, I think just a report on what was discussed around the public goods charge would be appropriate.
Well, what the item was voted to have it not move forward at the agenda today, and it will be discussed further in the Ledge Committee report on some language to see if we can find an understanding on, I think it was the fourth paragraph in the memo dated May something of 2015.
So we're going to bring forward, staff will bring forward some suggested edits that will be considered by the committee next month.
Thank you.
So between January and April, we typically provide updates on the status of water supply. Eileen has moved on to director of wastewater, so we now have David Briggs, who's going to be providing those updates.
Seen
its own new form here. So.
Raindrops, snowflakes, come on.
You have heard
I don't want to spoil the surprise, so.
Okay.
Okay, good afternoon. President McIntosh, members of the board, good Happy New Year. I'll review the water supply conditions briefly, and I'll also recap water year 2017 before we get into the current conditions. As you know, it was a record year last year. More runoff occurred in the McKelney watershed than any other year on record. Records go back to 1905, and a very impressive year. Almost 84 inches in the upper watershed from the four-station index. The average is about 44 inches, so about twice the average. Equally impressive locally. Reaching over 41 inches in the local watershed, average is about 26.5, so high production locally. And if you just look at January and February for a moment, over 22 inches in those 2 months, that's a third of an inch every day for 2 months straight. So however you slice it, it was a very impressive water year. And that ultimately led to nearly 2 million acre feet of runoff in the McKelney watershed. That was a record breaker. And that left us with 630,000 acre feet of storage at the end of September last year, setting us up very nicely for water year 2018. So getting into present situation, we're showing here the water production for the first 6 months of the fiscal year, the line in black. It's over top a reddish line, which represents last year, fiscal year 2017. Consistently above it, statistically, we're producing about 18 MGD more water than we did last year, about 10%. And for the year, we should average around 170 MGD of water production when all is said and done. And we're still way below the third line shown there, the peak from 2005 through 2007. Okay, so moving on to precipitation that we've accumulated so far. November seems like a long time ago, but November was very productive. December, not so much. And the January numbers here in the Upper McCallumet watershed, 1.9 inches, that reflects data through Sunday night. We're still QA, QCing that data. Probably got another inch and a half based on what happened in the last 24 hours, so that's probably approaching 3.5 at this point on January 9th. Similarly, locally, November was a big month. Hardly any precipitation was recorded in December locally. Up through Sunday night was an inch of rain. We got 2.5 inches yesterday, over 3 inches in downtown San Francisco. The storm really blew through here and produced a lot of rainfall locally. The storm tended to track south to north and less west to east, so it did not hit the McCallumet watershed as much as it did hit the Bay Area. But locally, if we update these numbers, it's closer to 3.5 inches in January so far. Okay, turning to Capel's Lake, the snowpack at 8,000 feet. The red line is where we are today, below average. We're also showing 2017, last year, way above. And the blue line, the worst year in the most recent drought, water year 2015. So we've not made a lot of progress in December. We're still below average. Starting to make some progress in January, but the storms have been warm. The storm yesterday was 32 degrees at Capel's Lake for most of the day yesterday, or above. So very little snow accumulated, even though way up in the watershed was accumulating precipitation. Looking at the numbers for the year to date, 46% percent of average through the local watershed. It's probably 5% higher if we include yesterday. Four station index upcountry is 77% of average. Add another 5% if we include yesterday, the Monday precip. Capel's Lake is going to remain at 23% until we get a cold storm. There is some indication that the storm door is going to remain open next week, and so maybe we'll see some progress there. Storage is looking good, just about as full as we can be considering flood control storage requirements. We're moving water from Pardee to Briones, so the local numbers will come up in the next month. 621,000 acre feet, though we're sitting pretty good with storage. And then finally, looking at the precipitation to date, again, this is numbers through Sunday night, so they're a bit higher now. 14.75 inch in the McCallumet watershed to date. And then if we forecast out using three exceedances, dry, wet, and average, again, this is probably a bit higher considering what just happened on Monday. The 90% exceedance is still tracking above 1977. The median, after we factor in yesterday, will probably track closer to the average. But the real take-home story is with the storage carryover from last year. Even with a 90% exceedance, we'll safely, from here moving forward, which I don't think we're going to track. I think we'll probably track more above 90% exceedance for the rest of the water year. But if we were, we'll still be above 500,000 acre feet of end of season storage in September. So, any questions? Oh, and here's the snowflakes.
Up high they are, 8,000 feet of snowflakes.
Thank you, David.
Yep, thank you.
Thank you, David. So the next item here, there's a short info memo in your packet from the director of our Human Resources Department Manager. If the board so chooses, they can appoint an ad hoc committee.
So what's the pleasure of the board? Do you want to change the current ad hoc committee? You know, it would be welcome.
I think it's a really good committee.
Doug, Andy? Would you like to sit on that committee?
We've already appointed the committee, and so we don't need to change the committee. So I would concur with a chair's determination to table that item.
All right, so that is myself, Vice President Patterson, and Director Frank Mellon.
So it happens when you leave the room.
All right, thank you. Also in your packet, we have the annual interdepartmental committee reports and the December monthly report. If you have any questions, I can work to answer those. I'd also like to share that it had been our plan, and in part the reason that we were having three committee meetings today was to try and free up time, because we to have a workshop on the 23rd of this month next to speak about as a part of the long-term financial stability discussion, to speak about the state's low-income rate assistance program. So we've been asking, and as of today, we don't have a report. That our understanding was that they were going to prepare a draft and allow it to be available for public review, and the idea was that the state would be finalizing that for delivery to the legislature in February. Rumors are circulating that it's on hold, but we can say for sure that we don't have a report, and so we would like to postpone, or our plan is to just wait a month, continue to hold the date for the February workshop, but see if we can have something to talk about, because it really makes sense for, if the state's going to do something, it makes sense for us to consider what we would do in that context rather than us rush ahead and then have the state change things. So that's our plan. We also have at your places a Speakers Bureau update, and this one now goes sort of in chronological order from the present into the future, and we worked all the way through this calendar year, and so you'll see a lot in there under the to be determined, you know, who's going to be speaking where, but what we're trying to do is make sure that we have resources available for all of these things that reflect well on the district. And we'll be adding, after some discussion internally, the availability of the of our new water dispenser trailer, for which there's some competition. And then also, we had last year, we added some parades. And we want to try to get those on the calendar, too, because all these things require staff resources. So look for the water trailer ad next time. And then after that, we'll try to engage with you and understand which parade board members would like to have some staff involved in, like we did last year.
Are we going to publish any or provide us with sort of the process for the criteria for deciding who gets water trailer when, or how we're divvying up around the wards, or, you know, any of that? Or is it just
our thought was that we would
first-hand gets, or
no? What we were thinking was we would try to make a decision based on staff where we thought we would get the most recognition for the trailer, and so larger venues, street fairs, that sort of thing, where we think we can make good use of it. That would be our starting point, and then we're very early. This is not the peak season right now, and then we could receive some input. Every time we bring out a trailer, we have. We have to balance how much we want to put in the way of staff resources into getting it there, into making sure that it's secure, and then taking it home. So, but we weren't going to establish, you know, a policy document on it, but just try to do our best guess, our best shot at what we think gives us the best value.
I have a question regarding parades. I know there's district-sponsored parades that we get involved with. What are the kind of parades you're talking about with staff, time, and equipment?
Last year, we had a request to use a district vehicle to bring a board member down the path of a parade. And we did that, and we offered it to other board members as well. And I believe we had two or three, Clifford? So a total of three board members participated in events. These are, you know, couple-hour undertakings.
I don't remember ever seeing that memo, but I could have easily missed it. So, but I'm just wondering if that can be construed from a perception issue of gift of public funds to benefit any board member, regardless who is riding on whatever kind of vehicle it is or whatever else. That's just something my thought. I mean, if it's like you're riding in the back of an East Bay Mud truck, does that give the is that benefiting could that be construed based on what we talked about in the beginning of closed session of a gift of public funds to benefit a board member?
Thank you for raising that. We'll take a look at it, and we'll also, as a part of that transmittal, bring forward the prior memo so you have it.
Okay, and I'm sure it was sent out. My fault, I missed it, but I don't recall it.
You also made a round of phone calls.
I think
Alex made a round of phone calls. At least I got a phone call.
Right.
There's only, I think, one parade in my area, and I know I didn't participate in it because I haven't for years. But
Risha would like to chime in.
I need to go back to the appointing the ad hoc committee. Even though we're keeping the same people, we need to have a vote. We need to have a motion and second and vote for that one.
I'll move the item.
Okay.
To keep the same three members of the ad hoc committee.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Any opposed? Any abstentions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
So we'll review the parade.
Maybe it's
nothing. I just said the smell test based on what we talked about before beginning the closed session. That's all.
All right. So that, but the intent was to try to get a calendar here that let everybody know what was coming, so that we it's transparent, and also staff is able to support them all. So we're working for next year, and that's all we have. All I have.
All right. Committee reports. Please submit items for future consideration to the general manager. Director comments. What's his name?
Hank Wiley.
If there are no director comments, I would like to adjourn today's
I have one comment.
Okay.
I just wanted to point out, Alex, you may know this already, but during the same time as we're now celebrating Hank Wiley, we also had Steve Phelps, who was president of the board out at Bishop O'Dowd, also passed having heart surgery. And I just wanted to share that with the board. We had worked quite closely on projects that really affected Bishop O'Dowd, and he was quite a person. The celebration at the Chapel of Lights here in Oakland, the whole place was filled. I mean, there was no standing room only. So I just wanted to make sure that some of the staff who worked along with him was aware of the fact that he had passed also. I think the memorial for Hank Wiley is what we're ending the meeting in, but I wanted that also to be on the record.
Yeah, and in terms of Hank, Hank was one of the founding members with me, and I think he was probably the last founding member of UMRA.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there's any other ones who... Richard, are there any other ones who've been there?
I don't think there's anybody either, John, that I recall. I know he was very instrumental in getting his replacement on UMRA and faithfully attended the meetings, even though he wasn't a member of the board.
And he also performed, was it last year, at the annual barbecue? His band.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then I would like to adjourn today's meeting in honor of Hank Wiley Jr., Henry David Wiley Jr. We are adjourned, returning here for our regular meeting of the Board of Directors at 1:15 on Tuesday, January 23rd. We're adjourned.